Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. We thank you for supporting your independent bookstore. When you shop with an independent, more of your money stays in the community. And it also enables us to continue to have events just like this one and bring your favorite authors in. I want to start by saying I have just heard exciting news. Caught is debuting at number one on the New York Times list this week. Is it number one? Winner of the Edgar, Seamus, and Anthony Awards, the first author to win all three, Harlan has 47 million books in print in 40 languages. His books have been called ingenious, poignant, and insightful, constantly entertaining, and must reading. And now, because you didn't come to listen to me, please join me in welcoming Harlan Coben, the author of Caught.
Must tilt up, tall man. Maybe just easier to hold. I always love holding it because I feel like singing Volare when I do this. You know, it's like, start going. Thank you very much. Good to be here. Like, all that kind of stuff. First of all, let me just say it's great to be back here in Denver. I don't know how many of you know this. I was born just east of Denver in Newark, New Jersey. So it's a thrill, really, to be back home amongst my people, you know. So it's really great to be here. It's been a weird tour. I just was realizing by tomorrow I would have done 8 nights, 8 hotel rooms. No, it's about now, I go to my hotel, and they all have those kind of keys. Oh, damn, what's my room number tonight? Twice I've gone to the night before's room and sort of, why is this thing not opening? Why does this door look at all familiar, you know? 8 nights, 12 flights. And the book came out last Tuesday, and the first thing we do is I did a 29-city radio satellite radio tour. We sit in a room on the telephone from 8 in the morning to like 2:30 in the afternoon, and they pipe in stations. And you never really kind of know what you get. Like, so one moment you're getting like, you know, some guy like, you know, Wacko and the Dude in the morning, you know, and they're yelling and screaming at you. And the next moment you have some guy who, if he took a lot of caffeine, would raise his voice to NPR level, you know, very sort of. And I'm like off on doing the wrong ones for the wrong things, and I'm freaking the guy out and all that stuff. And then the next day was a couple of TV appearances, and then hitting the road. It's so great to be finally here in my hometown. You know, after I was in Phoenix last night, good to be back in the hometown. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about how I write the books. I mean, what else am I going to talk about? Healthcare reform. And then I'll throw it out to some questions, and hopefully you people will, someone will raise their hand, because if not, I'm just going to call on you. And not all of you have done the reading. All right, so please start planning your questions now. The most common question that a writer... Oh, the other thing I kind of warn you is that a novel is a little bit like a sausage. You might like the final taste. You probably don't want to know how it was made. Okay, keeping that in mind. The most common question that a writer gets asked on the road is, how tall are you? 6'4". The most common question that I get is, where do you get your ideas? You know, like there's a boutique in the village that sells them. And the truth is, anything can stimulate an idea. A tabloid headline, boy 16 becomes grandmother, marries Ed Asner. You know what I mean? Like anything. One of those Ricky Lake shows, mommy won't let me get a nipple ring. You have to kind of let your mind open up. You know, you have these little hooks in your brain. And every once in a while, things kind of get caught. The real key is to ask what if all the time. In the case of, I'll give a couple of specific examples. In the case of Promise Me, a book a few years ago, the idea came to me when I overheard a couple of teenagers that I knew and loved talking about drinking and driving. And I pulled them aside and I said, Promise Me, title of the book, you won't do that. Here's my card, my cell phone, my home number, whatever. I don't care if it's 3 in the morning, I don't care where you are, I don't care how stoned you are, or what you're on. I promise I'll pick you up and not ask any questions. Some of you have maybe made the same promise, it's an unusual one. But that's the end of the story, really, in real life. But but fiction's asking what if. Well, what if a 16 or 17-year-old girl calls my hero? He goes into New York City to pick her up. He drops her off at what he thinks is a friend's house, and the next day she's gone. You know, no one in the house knows who she is. What if? Case of just one look. I was going one day to pick up something we all do, pick up the family photographs, you know, as I'm going through them, you know, for a second, just a split second, there's a picture Nara didn't take. It turned out the picture was upside down, but just go with me on this. I'm not the sharpest guy you've ever met. But I said to myself, what if there was a picture in here I didn't take? What if that picture changed my whole life? That was the little seed. The only problem with describing the books like this is it sounds kind of neat, but really the process is a little... It's sort of like, have you ever had one of those nights you can't fall asleep until you remember the name of the dog on Petticoat Junction? You know what I mean? Like, you're sitting in bed and like, there's that Bobby Sue and Billy Joe, and what the hell is the name of that damn dog? And you're sitting there in bed trying to think, and you go, "Why? How the hell I started thinking of something so stupid?" And you try to figure it out, and you try to trace your thoughts back, and you're bouncing all over the place. And it started like with nothing that had to do with it. It's like you were first thinking about how come Burger King doesn't serve Mountain Dew, you know what I mean? And how your mind just, that's really kind of how the process works. The example I often use for this one is a book I wrote a few years ago called Tell No One. And the way Tell No One came at me, I can be a little more specific with it, came at me from two different directions. One, I was watching a really crummy romance movie on TV. I won't mention the name of the movie, Message in a Bottle. And Nicholas Sparks, good friend of mine, love this stuff, but that movie. Anyway, what struck me about that movie was it was this story. We've seen a lot in these movies where the man's, you know, the wife dies, and the man's really sad, and he can't move on until a hot babe walks by, and then he's fine. Have you noticed that in these movies, ladies? In that case, it was Robin Wright, it's Angelina Jolie, Meg Ryan, whoever it is, Minnie Driver. All of a sudden, the guy's perky again. So I asked myself in those moments I get serious, which happens, what about the man who can't go on? What about the man who's truly destroyed and lost his soulmate? Is there a way I can find redemption for this guy? So I have this part of the idea, and it's over here. The second part of the idea is I lost my parents at a fairly young age. It's not much of a secret. I say it in almost every interview I do. And in fact, when I write Myron's parents, that's mine. I get too sentimental during those scenes. I overwrite them, tough skip them. They're a lot cheaper in therapy for me, okay? So if you don't like them, just skip them. Anyway, I have four kids. And one day I was on the computer and I was thinking the same way we all do. Wouldn't it be great if they were still alive? Wouldn't it be great if they could have met their grandchildren? And as I'm thinking these things, I'm looking at a webcam, and I think to myself, what would I do if I saw my parents on this webcam? And I took these two ideas and I put them together. A man and a woman, happily married. The wife is murdered. 8 years pass. He gets an email. He clicks a hyperlink. He sees a webcam, and his dead wife walks by. And the little Homer Simpson part of my brain goes, woo, yeah. That's the moment, you know? Oh, yeah. All right, donuts right there. That's the moment that you know as a writer. The problem with this is it sounds like this took about 15 minutes. This is 3 months of work, ladies and gentlemen. This is 3 months of sitting on the couch going, no, honey, I can't throw the garbage out. I'm working. Can't you see I'm working, woman? Hardest part of my job, convincing my wife I actually have one. So it takes about 3 months of trying to think of the idea. Oh, let me, Caught, this will be a little bit of a rant. Caught was also, came at me from a couple different directions and also a rant. And the rant is something that's always done wrong that always drives me crazy. So the what if in this one, I was watching one of those Dateline type shows about catching predators, you know, where the guy is trying to hook up with an underage girl. And I thought to myself, what would I do, what if, I was watching that show and someone I saw was on that show. Someone I knew and really liked and even loved was caught on that show. What would I do? Would I believe him? And what would his life be like? So I start the book from that guy's perspective. The very first line of the book is, I knew opening that red door would destroy my life. Because you know me, I don't like to start with 15 pages of sunrise and sunset. I want to get you right in. That was the one thing. The second thing is my oldest daughter turned 16 last week, and I love dealing with all the all the stuff that we're dealing with for teenagers today. It's not really new. I mean, my parents had to deal with it too. But the partying, the pressure to get in the right college, and this new world stuff, Facebook and the social sites, like, you know, all that kind of thing. So I wanted to do something with that, and so that happens. First, this guy gets caught in about two or three pages, and then immediately we switch to Haley McWade, who's a 17-year-old girl, and her parents, when the mother wakes up, finds the bed empty. And then 3 months later, we just skip ahead 3 months, the bed is still empty. And when these two stories kind of collide and come together later on, well, you'll see. It's one of my favorite novels, and I'm really excited about you guys starting to read it. The rant portion of what gave me this idea is the lead character in this book is a woman named Wendy Tynes. I haven't done too many lead females. In fact, I've only done one before. And the reason I love to write it them is because I hate the way women are usually portrayed in these, what we call women in Jeopardy novels. They're usually, like, naive to the point of brain trauma. You know what I mean? It's like, gee, there's a serial killer loose in the woods. I think I'll rent a secluded cabin, not tell anybody where I'm going, not hook up a phone line and hang out in my bra and panties all day. I mean, people, please. In today's society, for us to still be putting up with this nonsense. Every time I'm on book tour... It hasn't happened this time, but it will before the tour's over. Every time I'm on book tour, you know, in my room at night, I'm flipping stations because I'm a guy and that's what guys do. And I always go past the Lifetime Network. I love that, the Lifetime Network. And they always advertise the same four movies. They have more than four movies. Anyway, they always advertise movies starring one of our great actresses. I'm talking, of course, about Tori Spelling. Whom, like you, I often mistake for Meryl Streep, the two of them. I'm always mixing them up. And I'm not making this up, so I'm sure some of you have seen it. The name of the movie that she's always advertising is Mother, May I Sleep with Danger. No! This should be a very short movie, shouldn't it? Donna Mills or Michelle Lee or Jacqueline Smith, whoever says no. First of all, his name is Danger. Clue one, he's not for you. You know. Anyway, that sort of thing, that sort of anger of what was done wrong can sometimes inspire you to do what's done right. My very favorite quote on writing, the best piece of writing advice, and if you learn nothing else tonight, like you're learning something, this is the best piece of writing advice comes from the great Elmore Leonard, who says, I try to cut out all the parts you'd normally skip. Isn't that brilliant? And I do. I try to think on every page, every paragraph, every sentence, every word. Is this compelling? Is this gripping? Is this moving the story forward? If it's not, I got to find a way to change it. It doesn't mean you can't have character development. You could do. It doesn't mean you can't have larger themes. Caught is a novel about forgiveness more than anything else. You'll find out when you read it why. But even those have to be compelling. Setting has to be compelling. And setting is one of those things that should be on every page without ever even, you know, and most of the time you don't even mention it. I hate long descriptions of setting. What you're trying to do when you do setting is find the one thing that brings it all to life. I'm a member of a group in New York called the Adams Roundtable. It's about 10 or 12 of us. We're crime writers. We meet in New York City. I'm trying to Mary Higgins Clark, some members, Susan Isaacs, Lawrence Block, Peter Straub, Linda Fairstein. We meet in New York City. And one time the subject came up, what is the scariest noise in the world? Is, you know, a mother crying, a baby screaming, a man being tortured? And one of the members says, no. You're in that secluded cabin I just described to you. No, you're all alone. You're all alone in the secluded cabin. No one else is there. And then from upstairs, you hear the toilet flush. That's the moment you look for as a writer, the flushed toilet moment, if you will. If I'm describing to you Route 23 in Wayne, New Jersey, I'm not going to tell you it's four lanes across with hot people going too fast or it's divided in the middle. No, I will tell you, though, on Route 23 in Wayne, New Jersey, there's a tattoo parlor called, think about this, Tattoos While You Wait. Like, how else would you do it? Here's my arm. Put a skull and crossbones on that. I'll be back around 4. That will tell you more about Route 23 in Wayne, New Jersey than pages and pages of description. You know, we're also very honest people in New Jersey. I was, one of my stops last tour was Chesapeake, I think it's Chesapeake, Virginia or Maryland. I'm really good with geography. You know, well, just north of where I live. And they were telling me when I'm there, we're going to this event, and the guys, wait till you see, we're going to go across the Great Bridge. We're going to go across the Great Bridge. And wait till you see the Great Bridge. Now, I live in New Jersey near the George Washington Bridge. So I'm thinking the Great Bridge is going to be like, the Great Bridge is about the length of this room. I'm like, why don't you call it the little piece piece of crap bridge. Why would you call it the Great Bridge? In New Jersey, on Route 17 in Ramsey, New Jersey, where we have one of those no-tell motels, you know, the ones that have a sign saying, like, now featuring towels, you know, that kind of a thing. And it says color TV, and the C's in orange, the O's in green, the L's in blue. Like, somebody still has black and white TVs anymore, anyway. And it's no-tell, you know what I'm talking about, no-tell motels. Okay, good. And the name of it is the Fair Motel. We're not great. We're not even good. We're fair. I love that. I love that. And that kind of a thing can tell you more than pages and pages of description, finding the one little thing that can bring your writing out. Another question I get a lot on the road is about research. Oh, you must do a ton of research. You know all these things. First of all, when it comes to technology, so I'm telling you as a writer, if you're interested in writing, here's how much research you should do. Zero. Don't do any. Do zippo. I know I'm the only writer you've had up here who said that, right? Do zero writing. Here's why. I'm going to tell you why you should do. One, research is a lot more fun than writing. So I will use, and so will you, any excuse not to write, including doing research. I'm writing a scene on Park Avenue in New York, but first I have to fly there and smell the hot dog stands and see the girls. No, no, no. You know what it's like. You have an imagination. You know, as George Carlin said when asked George Carlin, what do you do for a living? I make shit up. You know what I mean? So that's what we do for a living. You know, you can fancy it all the way. That's what you do for a living. Do it now. Write the scene now, and one day you can go into New York and see what it's like. But don't use it as an excuse not to write. The second thing is, have you ever read that book and you know the writer did a ton of research, so he's throwing in all these factoids that are slowing the story down? Not a problem with me, because I don't know anything. I am from the hum a few bars and fake it school of research. Sound like you know what you're talking about. Asking with court, oh my, you know, you must really know about the internet. If you have a teenager, you know what Facebook is. There's nothing cutting edge about that. If you're a single woman out there and you're going on a date with a guy for the first time, you Google his name. If you don't, it's like saying you still use Betamax. Everybody does that. So my point is, don't worry so much about doing the research and getting it all right. If we worried as much about the story as we do as the research, it would probably be better off. I kind of alluded to the fact that writing, that you use any excuse not to write, and that's really a lot of it. I mean, writing becomes an obsession. There's three things that make a writer. Two are obvious, one is not. The two that are obvious are inspiration, being inspired to write, and perspiration, doing the work. But the third and probably most important is desperation, and that is, I'm not meant or fit to do anything else, like hold a real job. This is all I can do. You know, I was on a panel with a bunch of writers. Writers drive me crazy sometimes. And they asked, one of the questions was, you know, if you weren't a writer, what would you be? And one of the guys said, a U.S. senator. I'm like, oh, please. I don't know. I did duvet cover, maybe. I have no other marketable skills. I'm sloppy. I have bad work habits. I'm late. I'm forgetful. I get distracted. This is all I can do. And that fear that one day, as Steve Martin used to do, we used to have stand-up comedy routine, where you wake up at 6 in the morning to go to the pharmacy and sell flare pens, that fear is one of the things that drive you. Writers are constantly afraid. I know I hit you as a bastion of security. Trust me, I have my neurotic moments. I know, hard to believe, but go with me on this. Every time I'm writing the book, and this happens, and every writer this happens to, I've written, I don't know, 19, 20 books. I'm thrilled to be debuting at number one. I still don't believe I'm any good. And no, only bad writers think they're good. If there's a writer up here who goes, yeah, my book's pretty good, trust me, the book sucks. Trust me. All right? Guaranteed. But I'm sitting there, I'm writing the book. I'm like, oh my God, this is so bad. I lost it. When did I lose it? I was so good before. How did I lose it? Will I ever get it back? 3 minutes later, I'm like, oh my God, this is sheer genius. Someone's going to give that ad book that's already out there, and then we get this work of Shakespearean proportions, really, a chance. Goes on all the time. Every time I finish a book, a little voice in my head goes, that's it. You're done. There's no more ideas here. Sorry, shop closed. After a while, I know the voice is wrong, but the voice is always there. One of the advice, the obvious advice to somebody who wants to write is you have to read a lot. You know, you can't be a great musician without listening to a lot of music. You can't be much of a writer without reading a lot. But, and here's the caveat, even when I'm reading, I feel guilty I'm not writing. Writing is the only thing that I do that I don't feel like I should be doing something else. And that sounds weird, but there's the muse is not a beautiful voice in your head going, oh, the muse is more like your mother going, what, no phone call on a Friday night? What, you don't want to be with me? You'd rather be out with your friends? I tried, in order to be a more well-rounded person, like about 2 or 3 years ago, I decided to take up golf. Why I didn't just grind up glass and stick it in my eye, I don't know. Would have been much more enjoyable, but I took up golf. But even when I'm out on the course and it's a beautiful day, there's always that voice in my head that's going, you should be home writing. Of course, that's the guy I'm playing with. But also, even inside my head, there's that voice that says, you should be home writing. And that goes on whatever I'm doing. If I'm driving the kids in the minivan, when I'm on book tour especially, and I'm too exhausted to write, or whatever, you should be writing. You need that. If you're not feeling that and you can do something else, do it. This is the tough love portion. There's no excuse not to write if you want to write. I never buy it. Mary Higgins Clark is a dear friend of mine. When she was 42 years old, her husband dropped dead. She had 5 kids alone she had to raise and had a job, full-time job. So she wrote from 5 a.m. to 6:30. So if she could do it, don't tell me you don't have time to write. It's an excuse. And much like, oh, this, it's not weight gain, it's water retention. We have to face the facts. It was the great 20th century philosopher Cher. Cher, who said, and you might want to write this down, Cher said, excuses won't lift your butt, okay? Write that down. Put it on your computer. Live it. Become it. I love being a writer. It is the single greatest job in the world. I was on another panel when they were thinking annoying writers things. We were asked, all of us were not, number one New York Times bestseller, what's the negative, what's the downside of being a number one New York Times bestseller? I'll tell you what it is. Nothing. There's no downside. Yes, it's tiring to travel, whatever else, and things like that. But as the great Dan Fogelberg once said, the audience is heavenly, the traveling is hell. I can put up with it. This is not hard work, you know. Coming out and having you nice people here and asking me to sign the books and telling me you love my books, that's not hard work, trust me. I've had jobs, that's not hard work. So this is the fun part for me. The other thing writers say that really annoy me, there's always the writer, I don't know if you've had them here, and I hope they're not in your writing club, but there's always the writer who says, I write only for myself. I don't care if anybody reads it. That's like saying, I talk only to myself. I don't care if anybody listens. Writing from the beginning of time has been about communication. I don't exist as a writer. It's Berkeley's tree falling in the woods. If the tree doesn't make a sound, if no one hears it, doesn't make a sound. If I write a book and no one reads it, I'm sorry, I don't exist as a writer. And when you read it, And when you go home right now and you take this home and you read it, and Wendy and Dan and Wynn has a bit part in this, come to life in your head, all different from everybody else's, that's still the coolest thing for me. There's an Arab expression, when one man dies, a whole universe dies. When one of you reads, it's a whole new universe. These people come to life. And that's what's so exciting. A writer without a reader is a man who claps with one hand. You guys are the other hand. So this is, you know, now it's finally a book. This week, last Tuesday, it finally became a book. And I'm honored and thrilled to be able to be here with you guys tonight. Thank you all very, very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.